light our chalice. After she said a few words, let's sit quietly for a minute and try and put away cares and have a moment of silent meditation.
We light this chalice for the health of Gaia, the earth, with all of its wondrous living things. When we contemplate the whole globe as one great dewdrop, striped and spotted with continents and islands, flying through space with other stars all singing and shining together as one, the whole universe appears as an infinite storm of beauty. And that is John Muir in his Travels in Alaska, written in 1915. And now we will have a moment of silent meditation.
At this time, we can take the time, if we want, to tell others our joys, our concerns. The microphone will be coming so everybody can hear, I think. Who's got the mic? Thank you, Ralph.
It's a joy that this Friday evening, four members of Prairie will be performing in the Madison Choral Arts Society concert. There's a sort of cloud-colored poster on the bulletin board, and Paula, Mecha, Dan, and Dean will all be singing, so I invite you to come and hear them.
I have a joy. Whoever made the coffees this morning made good coffee.
I have several joys. I guess the biggest was last weekend when I was down for the Central Midwest Assembly, I had lunch with my brother's family. And my nephews are 25 and 27, and this is the first time I've talked to my 25-year-old nephew since his first communion. And it was just really wonderful to be with them and to be able to discuss our parents' situation, and I was just overjoyed. The assembly was great. Talking to Reverend Ralph was wonderful. We did converse at some length. And the third joy is I heard Ravi and Andushka Shankar in the concert, and it was just incredible.
Well, we're still a little disoriented because we got back at 11:30 last night from Canada, and that was both a joy and a sorrow. Bob's uncle is in the hospital and going to a nursing home. So his son came from Japan, and cousins came from other parts of Canada, and we all converged and spent the whole week cleaning out his house, pulling out all the memorabilia and cleaning out, and it was wonderful to spend time with them, but not a happy occasion in that sense, that it means kind of the denouement of his uncle's life.
I always feel refreshed and happy in spring. I walked out in the woods this morning and saw the spring beauty, the bloodroot, the trillium buds, and many, many, many daffodils and other plants. So I suggest everybody go out.
Some of you know that I took our draft right relations document earlier this year and wrote a kids version of it for my classroom that I've been doing all year, and each month we focus on one section of it, and the section of it that we're focusing on this month is we work out our disagreements peacefully. And we read a children's book to our class this week called And to Think That We Thought That We'd Never Be Friends. And basically in this story, the way that every disagreement gets solved is that the people make music together, and they form a bigger and bigger band making beautiful music together. And I thought about that today when I heard the beautiful music at the beginning of our service, and I encourage us to make beautiful music together today.
Speaking of beautiful music, About 3 weeks ago, I think, I asked if people would be willing to come to a concert with Jim Scott. And as I, about 27 people raised their hands. And we had about 12 people here last night. Those of you that raised your hands and didn't come, you don't know what you missed. This man is talented, and he is an extraordinary musician. I've never heard guitar or seen guitar. You watch his fingers. That was part of the joy. He was standing about where I am. And if, as I hope, we get done here this afternoon at some reasonable hour, Jim will be giving a concert at First Society to catch it if you can. He is marvelous.
Yesterday, I couldn't believe my eyes. I was just looking outside my window, and all of a sudden, there was this huge turkey that ran across the yard right out in the open. I haven't seen that before in our yard, so...
I was waiting for one of the participants to speak up. Prairie was well represented Friday night, am I right, at the Choral Arts Society concert in Easttown, in Oakwood Village East, and now I know where it is. Dan Proud and Paula Pachars, Dean Schroeder and Mechie Butler. And it was a gorgeous concert, and you should have been, would have been very, very proud of those four people.
Yes, that's right.
I forgot to mention, facilities are okay for a blood drive, and we'll probably be host for one in November or next May. James Reeve is going to have one possibly in September. So we all want to look for announcements.
Thank you. Our speaker today is Galen Smith. And I would ordinarily say that he is a man who needs no introduction. That he's had, I don't know, 60 years of botany under his belt. Some, maybe a little more than that even, give or take. And he's a wonderful person to be talking about John Muir. John Muir, the pioneer conservationist. And that sums up Galen, too. He is a conservationist. Please welcome Galen Smith.
Well, thank you, Mike. I'm going to start out here introducing our honored guests. First of all, Gaia.
Oh.
The Earth Goddess. And who just also happens to be my wife. And John Muir. who will say a few words on and off in his own words during the presentation. We've resurrected John from the grave. I think he did die in 1914, but he still lives with all of us. Today we're celebrating the 38th Earth Day. Earth Day was founded in 1970 by Wisconsin Governor Gaylord Nelson and millions of Americans who were deeply concerned then about the numerous assaults on nature which occurred mostly after World War II. The great grassroots movements of the late 1960s into the 1970s led to enormous advances in environmental protection, which would take us about a half an hour at least to summarize. You're familiar with most of those many pieces of legislation at the national level, the state level, the establishment of nature preserve systems all over the country in various states, et cetera, et cetera. Lots of organizations. But today on Earth Day, the 2007, the entire world is again alarmed about the deteriorating ecological conditions on the Earth, and the ecological health of the entire planet Earth is bad, and it is imperative that we address these environmental problems. However, we thought we'd have a little more upbeat service on this day. Instead, we seek the inspiration from the remarkable achievements of John Muir, who was one of the real heroes of nature conservation in the United States, and who we are delighted to have with us today. John Muir is also one of my and my wife's, Rose's, personal heroes. We were married overlooking the Pacific Ocean at Muir Beach, California, named after John Muir. Often enjoyed the magnificent Muir Woods Redwood Grove nearby. Backpacked and camped in the High Sierras, including part of the John Muir Trail, the high trail up around between 9 and 12,000 feet. And gave our son Peter the middle name Muir. I'd like to summarize a little bit about his John Muir's life, especially his early life, and we'll skip over most of the details of a lot of the productive years of his life because for lack of time, but there you have a handout here on chronology of John Muir's life. This is available on the web, by the way, if you do a Google search on John Muir, and that will help. And I want to highlight a few of the items that are on that chronology, and then I want to finish with some comments on general comments on his conservation legacy and his the historical context of his life and his religion. John was born in 1838 in Dunbar, Scotland, on the North Sea coast near the Firth of Forth, not far from Edinburgh. His parents were of Scotch and mixed Scotch and English heritage. John's mother, Anne, was quiet, conservative and affectionate, fond of painting, poetry, and natural scenery, and she was sustained by an inner calm. His father had a very different personality. He was much more rather difficult in many ways, but he ran a successful grain business, the business actually that he took over from his wife's family there in Dunbar. Before his religious fanaticism, however, led him to abandon such worldliness as fiddle music and art. He often played a fiddle and sang gospel hymns and ballads, which John finally remembered all of his life. And one of the ballads that he probably learned at the time will now sing, Wild Mountain Time, from the prairie. We're going to sing it, aren't we? Okay.
I think we have the handouts.
We have the handouts. Okay. It's in the prairie. It's in the sing out.
Rise up singing.
Rise up singing folk songs book.
We'll play a few more.
3. Sweetly blooming in the wild mountain thyme grows round the purple heather. Will you go, lassie, go? And we'll all go together to pluck wild mountain. Yon crystal flowing fountain, and on it I will pile all the flowers of the mountain. Will you go, lassie, go? And we all go together to pluck wild mountain thyme all around. Can surely find another where the well mountain time well the lovely, lovely. It brings back fond memories of our first trip, Rose and my first trip to Scotland, just over the border, as a matter of fact, which we shared with our daughter, Nevena, when she was about 14, I think. And we sang that song as we crossed the Scottish border, going up over the heathlands and among the flowering heather. It was great. During his 11 years in Scotland, John received an excellent education in school, but he also spent a great deal of time playing out and enjoying nature in the inland pastures, the ruins of Dunbar Castle, and the wild North Sea. 660 John Muir County Park now honors John's remarkable contributions to the preservation of nature. And is active in nature conservation in Scotland. Some printouts there on the self.
As a boy, I was. I've been growing.
fear of wild places and wild things. Fortunately, on my by this storm, there was no lack of most of the
is a assassin. This is a Christ. In humorless religion, and often whipped his children for minor infractions. And he also whipped them when they weren't able to memorize as many chapters of the Bible as he insisted on. From camp, by the way, begun under who had emigrated to the early and had his connections back. About him. Daniel had heard of religious freedom from the Campbellites, religious freedom and cheap land in America, and in 1849 he emigrated from Scotland and moved his family, now with three sons and four daughters. They had big families in those days. That made seven children. They were later to have one additional child. They had eight children altogether. From Scotland to Wisconsin, where he would find people of compatible religious beliefs and practices. John and his siblings were very fortunate that the land Daniel bought in Marquette County, Wisconsin, not really very far from here, about an hour's drive northeast, was a paradise of nature. It was on the shore of a lovely small lake, which is they called Mountain Lake, Fountain Lake, it's been called Muir Lake and other names too, which was full of water lilies, frogs, fish, and a myriad of other living things. The nearby limy fen and sedge meadows and an equally beautiful oak savanna supported many other plants and animals. It was an absolute paradise of natural areas. Part of the Muir farmland is now preserved as the Muir Park State Natural Area, and this is within the John Muir Memorial County Park, and it's really worth a visit. There's a couple of handouts, or a couple of documents of that off the web on the table. Now, John Muir himself will share his memories of life on that farm.
This sudden splash into pure wildness, baptism in nature's warm heart, how utterly happy it made us. Nature streaming into us, wooingly teaching her wonderful glowing lessons, how unlike the dismal grammar ashes and cinders too long thrashed into us. Here, without knowing it, we were at school. Every wild lesson, a love lesson, not whipped but charmed into us. Oh, what glorious Wisconsin wildness. Everything new and pure in the very prime of the spring when nature's pulses were beating highest and mysteriously keeping time with our own. Young hearts, young leaves, flowers, animals, the winds and the streams, and sparkling lake, all wildly, gladly, rejoicing together.
Thank you, John. Well, John's life on the lake farm and later on another farm that his father purchased was full of hard, dreary work, which his father imposed on the children. The boys in the family had to be the main laborers. They built a house, they cleared all the land, they were pioneers, they grew all their food and so on. However, they also had many, many pleasures in nature and made very good friendships with neighbors. There was one neighbor especially that was very important to John, who his father wouldn't have, because of his religious beliefs, his very severe Christian religious beliefs, the only book he would allow in the house is the Bible. And John really liked to read lots and lots of things. He loved to read. He's a very bright guy. He learned to read when he was very young. And so it was one of the neighbors that had lots and lots of books in their house and had a little less rigid religion, provided him with that great pleasure of reading. And he read Emerson and a lot of other good stuff, in addition to making good friends with those people in that family. He did not attend school as a youth in Wisconsin at all from age 11 on until he finally went to the university. And he was about 20 years old, I think, for about 2.5 years, went to the University of Wisconsin. During his time on the Wisconsin farms and at the university, as many people know, he famously displayed a remarkable ability to invent and make many very complex clocks and various other mechanical devices. He was a genius, absolute genius. He won great praise and awards for his inventions. These skills were to provide him with livelihood in the early part of his life later. He was very valuable as an employee in industrial plants of various sorts. He especially worked in sawmills and similar places where he invented all kinds of things. I think he could have made millions and millions of dollars in his life if he had followed that career as an inventor and an engineer. He was greatly distressed by the Civil War, which then was going on during a period when he was a student at the university here. And he didn't want to serve in the Army, especially after visiting the wounded soldiers at the Army Hospital at Camp Randall right here near the university in Madison. To escape being drafted, in 1864, he briefly went to Canada to escape the draft. There were two drawings of the draft. While he was still living in Wisconsin, his name was not drawn. His older brother went to Canada to avoid the draft. Then John followed him. And he settled for a while at Meaford, Ontario, which is near, unlike Huron, near Georgian Bay. It's a lovely, lovely area. And he found some beautiful nature there and lived with family where he worked and made lifelong friends there. And the organization, the Canadian Friends of John Muir, honors Muir and maintains ties between Medford, the little town of Medford, which has deep Scottish roots, in Dunbar, Scotland. They have a web page. There's some printouts from that web page. While working in a sawmill in Indianapolis, Indiana, he was temporarily blinded when one eye was pierced in an accident. This traumatic incident convinced him that he should search for his bliss, and not in engineering and inventing and so on, and in factories, but in nature, rather than... Okay. This led to his famous 1,000-mile walk to Florida, which many people know about. What he did is walked all the way from Indiana, more or less, to Georgia, and then crossed to Florida. And it was a very amazing experience. It's worth reading about the whole book that he wrote about the subject. He ended up in Cuba because he had all the intentions of going to South America and exploring the Orinoco and the Amazon after having read Alexander von Humboldt's books about that. And but the trouble is that he got very sick. He nearly died of malaria down there in Florida. And he recovered very slowly. And when he was on Cuba, he was still sick and realized that it was a crazy idea to go on to South America. So he had been, he had a very special friend in Jeannie Carr, who was the wife of one of his teachers here at the University of Wisconsin, who taught science. I've forgotten his first name now. And some people say it was a romantic relationship. It was, but they were very, very good friends for a long time. Jeannie Carr had written him that he really should go to Yosemite in California. And so it seemed very attractive to him as he recovered from his malaria down there in Cuba. And he shifted gears completely and ended up in California. I went by boat and so on. And when he got into California, he landed in San Francisco, and he writes that he was horrified by all the people there and all the hustle and bustle, and in the city of California, in the city of San Francisco, in what year was that? Let's see, 1868. And he left immediately as soon as he could get out of the city and traveled out in the countryside. Well, he was lucky to get there in the spring. I think it was late March. And the lowland areas of California were in bloom. It had a good summer, a good winter rains. And there were great masses, fields, millions of acres in the Central Valley, in the foothills of the Sierras, and the foothills in the hills near San Francisco, of wildflowers. And he found his bliss in nature there. He discovered it suddenly. This was where he belonged. In 1969, he worked as a sheep herder in the Sierra Nevada. That's not quite true. His whole book about it, he wrote about it. You really ought to read that book. I read almost all the books he's written. A big stack of books in preparation, and it's one of the best. Anyway, he did work with about 1,000, 1,400, I think about 1,400 sheep, where they took them all up, all the way up to the high mountain meadows as the spring and summer progressed. But he was terribly distressed by all the damage that the sheep did to all the meadows and the vegetation there. And you realize that there were also large numbers of other herds of sheep all over the Sierras, and the same thing was happening. Then he found work in Yosemite Valley, where he built himself a cabin and lived for about 4 years. During his stay in Yosemite, he extensively explored the Sierras and other mountains, where he did pioneer work on glaciation. Over the next 10 years or so, he became the expert on glaciers of the whole western North America, from California all the way to Alaska. The best expert. And he wrote extensively on glaciers. And people like LeConte, who was one of the early pioneers in geology and glaciation, learned a great deal from him. And a lot of his work has been published, and it's still basic reference material on glaciers. In that period when he lived in Yosemite, he met many and spent some time with many very important people who are important it was important for him to meet them because they got good ideas from him, and it was important for him to meet them because he got good ideas from them. Ralph Waldo Emerson spent several days in Yosemite, and they spent a lot of time together. And the artist William Keith, a fellow Scot, he did paintings. They became very fast friends, partly because they were both Scots. Geologist Joseph LeConte, botanist Charles Sargent, and Asa Gray from Eastern United States. These were top men in their fields. And Sir Joseph Hooker from England, who was probably the top botanist in England at the time. John Muir met in 1874. He met the Strenzel family, who had a big ranch over closer to the San Francisco Bay Area, close to the San Francisco Bay Area near Martinez. And eventually he married their daughter, Louie, in 1880. And they had they settled down in the Strenzel, on the Strenzel family ranch, lived with the Strenzels for a while. Now, they had two daughters, Helen and Wanda. John was a very loving father of Helen and Wanda while they were babies, children, and all their lives. Now, he was a very successful rancher. They developed a very economically successful business raising grapes and cherries, and he made lots of money from this. John had developed a really effective work ethic, I think, working under his father. And he worked so hard that he made himself ill. This was about a 12-year period. And by the end of 12 years, they had built a huge house that still exists. It's now preserved as a historic landmark out there. And he had lots of money in a whole bunch of different banks. But he was coming close to death, probably, from upper respiratory infections especially. It was pneumonia that finally killed him, by the way. So I think it was real danger. So his wife and other friends and everybody urged him to get out and get it back into wilderness. So he went off to Alaska again after some other trips prior to that in 1880. And so he cured his illness by getting out and walking on the glaciers in Alaska. He was amazing, absolutely amazing man. It was, I think it was that trip where he had this dog named Stikine as a companion in exploring a glacier, and he wrote a children's book called Stikine, which is a real classic. Yeah, isn't that a wonderful book? By then he was doing a lot of writing, and a lot of it was published in the Century magazine, and he had met the editor, assistant, associate editor of the Century magazine in Yosemite, and it was fast friends of him's. One of the subsequent trips was another trip. They had several other trips to Alaska in 1881, the next year. 2 years later, I guess. They went on the Corwin, a sailing boat, to northern Bering Sea. And he visited the Siberian mainland, where he got to know the Chukchi natives there, the various big islands of the northern Bering Sea, where he got to know the natives there, and the Pacific coast of Alaska. They were searching for information on several lost whaling vessels, and he kept a careful journal, and that was turned into a book posthumously published called The Voyage It's called The Voyage of the Corwin. It was a separate book. There's another book called Travels of Alaska. He was in Alaska a lot. That's another reason Rose and I appreciate John Muir, because we lived in Alaska for a while. I have to fast forward here because we're going to be late, running late. I want to mention about three things that had to do with conservation. He, as you all know, was instrumental in getting Yosemite National Park, well, most of you do anyway, established as a national park. At first it was set up as a state park under local political control in the state, but it was absolutely essential that it be a national park where you got it out of under the control of the local power brokers and industrialists and so on in California, and a little better protected. And there was a long fight over 5 years or so, and finally when the legislation was passed in Washington to establish it as a national park, more or less with the boundaries that John had drawn on the map. There were all kinds of different proposals as to where the boundaries, but John had drawn those boundaries on foot. He spent, I don't know how many, thousands and thousands of hours, I think, roaming on foot, exploring the whole, say, the southern half of the Sierras, and he knew every inch of that area. The second thing I'd like to mention is his, jumping forward just a little bit. Actually, it was 1907 to 13. Part of the Yosemite National Park was the beautiful Hetch Hetchy Valley. And it was very much like, it is very much like, or was very much like Yosemite Valley. Looks quite similar, with similar rock formations and so on, the beautiful meadows in the bottom. And as you all know, the Hetch Hetchy Valley is now a reservoir as a water supply for San Francisco. And that happened in 1913 when Woodrow Wilson signed the bill authorizing the dam. That just about ruined John. By then he was 73 years old. And his health was starting to fail a little bit, I think, partly because he had been working so terribly hard as a conservationist. And they lost that battle to preserve the Hetch Hetchy. And John himself wrote about it, and I'd like him to share with you.
It is a wonderfully exact counterpart of the Merced Yosemite, for not only in its sublime rocks and waterfalls, but in the gardens, groves, and meadows of its flowery park-like floor. These temple destroyers, devotees of raging commercialism, seem to have perfect contempt for nature, and instead of lifting their eyes to the god of the mountains, lift them to the almighty dollar. Damn Hetch Hetchy, as well damn water tank, for water tanks, the people's cathedrals and churches, for no holier temple has ever been consecrated by the heart of man.
Okay, now we're running short of time, so I thought we would. So I think we'll stop at this point. And I missed.
Can you say anything about your religion or lack of it?
Well, okay. Muir broke with his father early on, even when he was in Scotland. He argued with him about his father believed that every word in the Bible was written by God, essentially, right? And John realized he was very smart and realized as he was a boy growing up that that couldn't be true. And so he had huge arguments with his dad throughout his life. And his religion, the way he ended up, I'm going to read quickly here from a very interesting article that really is what you should read. It's on the web. It's by a man named Mark Stroll called God and John Muir, a psychological interpretation of John Muir's life and religion. He said the main influences of his life appeared in his journals and publications. Okay. The main influences of his life appeared in his journals and publications. From the university, he acquired a scientific appreciation of the working of things. From the transcendentalists and the romanticists, the beliefs in nature's connection with higher impulses and powers, and in a near pantheistic immanence. And from liberal Christianity, he got a feeling for a benign love of God. And from evangelical Christianity, a desire to preach salvation to the nations, albeit in a heavenly, not in a heavenly, but in a wilderness salvation. This is a very interesting final word on that. So driven was John's father Daniel in his pursuit of godliness that he drove his son away from him and his life and his religion, and into the wilderness, into a wilderness suffused with the divine light of a loving, accepting deity. That Muir was thus reborn, not from a life of sin to submission to the God of the Bible, but from a life of repression to revelation of the God of nature. This has left us the rich an inspiring legacy of John's wilderness gospel. So that is a brief summary.
Would you like a next?
Okay. Now I just want to say, for those who haven't seen it, John Muir's desk is in the State Historical Society building on Library Mall here on campus. And Galen mentioned his genius and his work with clocks. I won't even attempt to describe the desk. But if you go see the desk, you'll get some great insight into his capabilities with mechanics and wood carving and creation of fantastic objects.
And then along with that, you should read in the biography, there are two wonderful biographies that are sitting on the table over there. And John's book, My Boyhood and Youth, which writes in detail about that part of his life.
It sounds from your talk as though he pretty much educated himself as far as science is concerned, or with connection.
He had the beginnings of science education, self-education, but also at the university here. I don't know the details of how much he learned. His botany he learned from a student, but he learned some geology and other science from
By observation.
Dr. Carr, I think he was a generalist. Yeah.
I read something long ago that stuck in my craw, and I just wondered whether it was true or not, and that was that John Muir once lashed himself to a limb of a tree in a windstorm in order to experience what a tree would feel like.
John did.
Is that true?
That was one of the numerous things, the physical things that he did. He was a daredevil. He was a daredevil when he was a little kid. It was remarkable that he survived early childhood without serious injury or death. That's right. He fell several times in the high Sierras in his mountaineering. He was a daredevil mountaineer. And one time he knocked his head and had brain concussion, obviously, and came to some time later. He was all by himself way up in the wintertime, I think, in a high Sierra. It was cold. He very nearly died of that. Several other times he fell into a crevasse in a glacier in Alaska and almost died. It's just absolute miracle that he lived to be 74 years old.
I thought I would just share
when our family took a road trip last year to Yosemite, we were so inspired spending a few days there that we wrote many poems, which, given our sort of general lack of talent, were all in the form of limericks. And we have one I'll share with you about John Muir. There once was a fine man named John Muir who impressed with a landscape's grandeur. For beleaguered Yosemite, he had a remedy. A national park was the cure.
Anybody else? Here, Anetchi has some. One more.
Okay. I believe it was in Stikine that he was traveling in the glaciated or icy parts of Alaska. And the dog was with him and refused to jump a chasm because it was too wide. So he threw him across, knowing he was going to get there himself, I guess.
So, we'll go on.
Thank you, Galen. It was good to have you talk about John Muir, because John Muir is an inspiration to us all, and so are you. It's Reverend Ralph has a basket or two, and baskets will be passed around, taking up a collection. We try to run this place on love. It's a good try, but we need money as well. Do contribute. Thank you. And we're going to play another Scottish song for offertory music. If I can get in there, go for it, guys. But That's what we were doing there. And that wasn't bad, was it? So, actually, Loch Lomond is nowhere near Dunbar. But that's, who cares? Never mind. It's all in Scotland. They all talk funny. That's quite possible, yeah. I wonder if there is anybody here today who would care to introduce themselves. We would love to have you do that. Visitors? Guests? Yes. Thank you.
I'd like to introduce us. This is my wife, Grace, and I'm Alan Correa. We live in Lexington, Kentucky. And we met some of you last year. We made this little pilgrimage up to Madison last year and this year as well. And I just like to express, I didn't know when to stand up, whether in the gratitude section or later on. But Grace and I have the good fortune of having met the Smiths 41 years ago when we all taught at Whitewater together. We won't go into that. But I'd like to say on this day that, you know, it's one thing to know that we come from the earth and we're going to return there, but it's another thing to know people who can tell you about the earth and what comes from it and what's going on in nature. And as regards this gentleman up here who calls himself John, I'm not sure that that is the real John Muir. But I can say that Galen Smith and his life companion, Rose Smith, are the closest thing that I know to John Muir.
Yes.
I'm Kim Gienick, and this is my my honey, Willa Schmidt. And she knew Gaia by under the pseudonym Rose Smith when they both worked at Memorial Library. And then I met Rose and I met Galen. And then Galen got me onto the board of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. So we get together socially, and Galen and I go to our board meetings and stuff. And so I was happy to come up and hear his talk about John Muir. And I read the Mountains of California a year ago, and then we actually traveled through the Mountains of California on the train. And then I actually saw a bird that I had read about in that book that I had never seen before in Colorado last year. So that guy was, John Muir is a wealth of information, and so is Galen. So.
Yeah, the bird was the dipper, and it was some...
Or the water ouzel.
Because when we saw this bird, Kim was just ecstatic. He just couldn't get over it. There it is. There it is. It's right there. Right on cue.
John wrote a wonderful essay that's been rewritten many times on the ouzel. It's kind of world famous.
This is only our second time here, so I guess I'll still introduce us. My name is Larry Erickson, and my wife, Karen.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Nice to see you again.
This is one of... This is one of our members, believe it or not.
Many of you know me, Diane Darwin. I'm still inactive, I guess you should say, yeah. Member of Prairie, but I'm very happy to be here and to hear Galen's talk. I have the pleasure of getting to see Galen at Birch Hall from time to time. So, great job, Galen.
Good to see you, Diane.
Nice to see all of you.
Nice to see you.
There are several... Two, actually. That's not several. There are two announcements in your bulletin today. Now, you turn the page there, you'll see some other really good stuff coming up on our calendar. Are there any other concise and pertinent Prairie announcements? Oh, got to have one. Yes.
Here, Dr. Franson.
I had
I attend a yearly bioethics conference at the Promega, which is directed towards teachers, physicians, scientists, and the clergy. And to my joy, Ralph was there. And very interesting stuff. And I will see that these bulletins get here so people can sign up for this interesting program that comes on each year. They were discussing enhancements and therapy, enhancements being things that make you better than normal, and therapy treatments being things that help people who feel they aren't quite normal be normal. I could tell you more, but I won't now.
Thank you, Mary.
Our monthly breakfast for the men's drop-in shelter is this Tuesday morning, and I forgot to bring the can out, but I'll put it on the greeting table afterwards. I would like to take a collection to buy the breakfast food. And the warm weather must have reduced their numbers somewhat, but there is still a need for it. So appreciate your contributions. And if anybody's able to work that morning to cook and serve, let me know. Thanks.
Thank you, Paula. Don't forget our annual meeting. We'll start at 11:45 precisely. It's advertised for 11:45, and I've caught flack in previous years for beginning early. But there are people, believe it or not, who don't come to Sunday service but do want to come to the meeting, so we won't start without them. No. I said we'll start the meeting at 11:45. Meeting. We'll start the eating as soon as we can. And sitting somewhere close to you is a book that they tell me is covered teal. I would have said it was blue, but, you know. And if you look in there at number 1067, the choir is going to lead you in a little song with the elements.
This is a piece we haven't sung before as a group, so we're going to have the choir sing it, the first verse, and I want you to just kind of say the words as we sing them, so you begin to, but the words are really excellent, and we'll try not to go too fast. Then we're going to stop and start again, so you get a chance to actually sing the first verse, and then continue and sing the whole way through. And there'll be a little drum accompaniment, so there'll be like four beats of the drum between each verse.
Oh,
Are there closing words? And Galen is... Yes, it's going to be Galen, and not someone else. I've got it up here, Galen. Okay. And after that, there will be a postlude by this wonderful band up here.
Okay. This is a quote from that essay, the marvelous essay that Mark Stroll, I don't know who Mark Stroll is, but he's obviously a very bright guy, that I quoted from earlier. John Muir lived to bring people back to the wilderness for the spiritual and physical healing it would give them. But even in the 1870s, he realized that the pure wilderness of America, wildernesses, areas of America, were fast disappearing before the woodsman's axe, the shepherd's flock, and the miner's pick. Muir's prose served to awaken the public to the thoughtless waste and unrestrained exploitation that were destroying natural beauty in the United States. More than anyone else, he massed public sentiment behind the preservation of America's forests and mountains. The entire American environmentalist tradition, from the National Park Service to Earth First, owes him a great debt. And in closing, because I have the microphone, I want to thank everybody for all of your contributions. Of course, I want to thank Bob Park, who's not really John Muir. It would have been easy to imagine. And Rose, my wife Rose, who is not really Gaia, but good. And all these wonderful musicians and everybody who helped, Reverend Ralph, and everybody who helped out, and all the kind words, especially that I heard today. And I'm not sure they were deserved, but it's very nice. Thank you very much.